move that? Can you move that back? First of all, Vishus, thank you very much for this chance to think through a Torah subject together. As you all know, Or Avraham is the greatest institution in the Northern Hemisphere and deserves to be supported. I'm not sure what you'd like to talk about or hear. Maybe let's talk about perhaps the subject of Emunah with a view to understanding it perhaps in a fresh way, and also with a view to understanding it from the perspective of sharing with people who are new. I'm sure you're all involved in outreach in some way. I'm sure you're all heavily involved in teaching Kiruv one way or another. So how would one present this subject to an atheistic world, to a world that is distant? What are some of the tools that have proved to be effective in beginning the discussion of Emunah to a world that is not yet friendly to the idea? Is that okay? Can we do that? Anyone out there? I'll share with you a presentation that I found to be effective in this area. And you know, one builds experience, and some things turn out to be more effective, some things turn out to be less. And I think a more mature approach to the question of belief and faith is the one I'd like to share with you, and I hope you find it useful. Are you going to do that the whole time I'm speaking?
Just do what I'm told.
So here's the problem. The question is that the word Emunah we translate as faith or belief. And the meaning of belief is something that you relate to without knowing. That's what it means. Belief means something that you cannot know. Right? The fact that you're sitting in front of me today is something that I know. The word belief is inappropriate. What's another side of that wall is something I have to believe. I have no experience of that. And that's why it's called blind belief or blind faith, a leap of faith. That's what belief means. So we translate Emunah as belief, and we run into trouble. Because when you start discussing it with somebody intelligent, the problem that sooner or later raises itself, either they're aware of this problem in the beginning, or the discussion will get you there, or even worse, there's a subliminal problem underlying their concerns, and it's this. And this problem is particularly acute in a Western intellectual framework. And the problem is, can you know the objects of our belief or can you not? And to put it at its most basic, can you know that Hashem exists? Right? And that's a legitimate question. The Rambam's not afraid to deal with that question and its proofs and its evidence. And Kuzari and many sources deal with that. And that question is really, can you know that Hashem exists? And all the spin-off issues from that, the giving of the Torah, the uniqueness of the Jewish people, all the issues, all the way down to the more difficult ones, the more difficult areas of Torah to understand and accept. But it begins with the most basic of all questions, which is really the question of Hashem's existence. And the problem we have is this, to make it very clear. Can you know that or can you not know it? If you can know it, we shouldn't be talking about belief, we should be talking about knowledge. And if you can't know it, why should I believe it? If you cannot know it, why should I commit my life and maybe have to die one day for something that cannot be known? And this is the problem that's at the back of the mind, if not the front of the mind, of a Westerner with whom you discuss the subject. He's been trained in a Western scientific empirical mode. There has to be proof for things. If not, and proof has to be absolute, by the way. Proof, you know, you either prove it or you don't. It's not... It's one of those things that, and you know it from learning, if you learn up a sugya and there's 5 or 10% of it that's not quite clear and clinched, the whole thing's insecure. So that's our question. The question is, can it be known? Can it not be known? If someone asks you that question in a Kiruv setting, do you know? Can you know that Hashem exists? Can you not know it? Whichever side of that fork, whichever fork of the intersection you choose, you'll be in trouble. If you say that you can know it, the question becomes, why do we call it belief? And if you can't know it, why should you do it? Are we together on that? Yes. Speak English?
Why do I have to know
You don't have to. You can believe it if you like. But if you believe it without knowing it, you're on very, very soft shifting sands. Because the next person will come along and say he believes something else, and that'll be cool as well. And if you argue with someone, and you believe the opposite of what he believes, that'll be fine. Which means you're really trashing the objectivity of the subject. So if you argue with a Christian, and he'll demand the right to believe what he believes, or a Muslim, and he's got the right to believe what he believes, and then you argue with a Haitian voodooist, and he's got the right, and you cool say, yeah, that's fine. So then everybody's allowing everybody. In England today, where I live, it's considered impolite to argue about religion. Because he's got a right to believe what he wants to believe, even if it's the opposite of what you believe, which means there's no objectivity at all. That's very unsatisfying to a logically trained thinker. So you can wake up in the morning and be born again and believe whatever you want, but there's no basis to that. That's the problem. And to put it further in context, we live in a Western mode. The Arab world has its own take on this and its own issue. If there's time, we'll try to show where that problem, the focus of that problem. But in the Christian Western world, faith is exactly a personal feeling that has no objective basis. That's exactly the background. When a Westerner comes to you and talks about emunah, they've translated it as faith or belief. In their mind, you're talking about something that is a warm, fuzzy, personal commitment that you have a right to do, and it does not stand on evidence. Right? Example. I'll give you an example. One of the hottest topics in Western intellectual debate today is the debate between science and religion. You can't miss that, right? And that debate, when you look at those debates, you'll find something fascinating. You'll find that the people engaged in those debates at the highest level, the highest intellectual level, are people who are always incredibly well qualified scientifically and almost never have any religious knowledge. Right? Why? Because in the Western head, science and a technical professional field has to be studied at the highest level, but religion is a personal feeling. And therefore you don't need qualification. Time magazine, a few years ago, they ran a debate between Richard Dawkins, who is a very eminently qualified scientist, a brilliant and articulate writer, a very violently atheistic individual. And the religious position was taken by a person called Francis Collins, a Nobel Prize winning geneticist. These are two of the most highly qualified scientists in the world. Neither of them have any religious training at all. How do you engage a subject at the highest intellectual level with no qualification and no knowledge? Because religion is not something, right? So, you know, just to put this from the sublime to the ridiculous. Here in Yerushalayim a few years ago, they organized a debate on science and religion. So the first speaker was a world-famous astrophysicist. Is Jewish, unfortunately, very atheistic. His great-grandfather wrote a Talmudic dictionary, but by his generation, there's a lot of assimilation. And he is a very brilliant individual. I actually like him because he said one good thing. He said that he has a recurring nightmare. This is his worst nightmare, is that at the final stage of human intellectual development, when the scientists like him finally pull themselves over the last precipice of a mountain, they'll find a bunch of bearded guys sitting up there saying, "What took you so long?" That's his nightmare. But anyway, so like he's open to the fear. You know? But he began the debate like this. He's now speaking about atheism, right, in a religious context. So he began the debate like this. "Ladies and gentlemen, I don't know much about religion." Can you imagine starting a debate like that? You've come to Yerushalayim, you've been brought in, you're now a Nobel Prize winning authority, you're now going to debate a subject, and your opening statements, you actually don't know anything about it. Right? But that's acceptable. But it began like this. "Ladies and gentlemen, I don't know much about religion, but I think it can be summed up as, do unto others as you would have them do unto you." And on the basis of that, he gave his talk. The next speaker was Rabbi Revson. Those of you know, he's an Englishman with a dry and acid sense of humor. He got up and he said, "Ladies and gentlemen, I don't know much about astrophysics, but I think it can be summed up as twinkle, twinkle, little star." So, you see, what we're talking about, and the point he was making, of course, is that the incredible disparity between the sides is that in any technical subject, you're expected to be qualified at the highest level, and when it comes to the Christian religious view, it's simply a personal feeling. It doesn't need any evidence. I'll give you another example. I was traveling overnight on a very long, tiring flight from London to Johannesburg, and I turned out to be sitting next to a person who told me that he's an Episcopalian charismatic preacher. Don't ask me what it is, but it's definitely Christian. And during a whole flight, he tried to convert me to Christianity. About 2 o'clock in the morning, you know, he wasn't making much progress. So he tried to show me that the founder of Christianity could well have been the Messiah, because his father Joseph, the carpenter in Bethlehem, was descended from the house of David. You know, all four Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, they all detail the genealogy of Joseph, the carpenter, from David, from Yehuda. Because to be Mashiach ben David, he must be descended from the house of Yehuda. So all the Gospels, they argue slightly about the details, but they all trace Joseph, the carpenter, in Bethlehem, they all the father of JC, they all trace his genealogy back to David to prove that he could well have been the Mashiach. So we established this genealogy very firmly, and I said to him, but look, you as a Christian, don't you believe that his father had nothing to do with his birth? Problem? Right? Problem? He said to me, what does logic have to do with religion? It wasn't being facetious. He meant that I am confused, because I'm trying to be logical about a faith matter, and that's just wrong. He said to me that because it's illogical, our faith is greater. Now, in Jewish thinking, that's ridiculous. But in their world, religion is something that is a personal commitment, conviction, like maybe you were indicating. You choose it and you choose to believe it, but with no objectivity. And that's very unsatisfying and very dangerous. It does not sit well at all with a Western intellectual, scientifically trained approach. So that's not our approach. So how do you formalize this subject when you deal with people who ask these questions? And I think a more mature approach to it is something like this. And this approach Rav Simcha Wasserman taught us and various other sources and inputs, but I think you'll get further like this. I'm not claiming this is the whole subject, but I think this is a way to begin the discussion. Our approach is that Hashem's existence can be known. It can be known. Our claim is that it can be known. Then two questions follow. One, how do you get the knowledge? And two, why do you call it belief? That's what you'll have to deal with. So let's deal with those. First of all, how do you get the knowledge? And here, one of the most important elements to lay down in your discussion with someone who's new is that we're not talking about absolute knowledge. We're not talking about absolute knowledge. When I claim that Hashem's existence can be known, I'm not claiming that it can be known with absolute clarity. And the reason is not because it's in any doubt, but because the human mind is not capable of absolute knowledge. The human mind is not capable of absolute knowledge, which means you can never achieve absolute knowledge about anything, not only about Hashem's existence. This is very well known. Anyone who's had any background in philosophy will know that we are incapable of absolute knowledge, and it's very easy to show. I'll give you an example. Let me ask you a question. Are you awake right now? I mean, those of you who are. Are you awake right now? Okay. Are you sure? Okay. Are you absolutely sure? No. You may be back at home in bed dreaming that you're listening to an amazing shir on the subject of Emunah, right? And you think you're awake. When you dream, you think you're awake. That's why you can go through ecstasy in a dream or abject terror. If you knew that you were dreaming, you wouldn't be afraid. The nature of a dream is that it purports to be reality. And therefore, in a dream, you think you're awake. So when you're awake, how do you know you're not dreaming? I mean, if this bothers you, seriously, you need psychotherapy, you know. But the point is that there's no absolute certainty. There's no formal demonstration of the fact that you're awake. By the way, if you ask the question as a complete aside, why do we dream? Just as an aside, if at this point in the discussion your Talmud stops you and he says, why did Hashem, isn't it cruel of him to put us into a situation of unreality? After all, we know this is an Alma de Shekra, right? This is an illusory world. Why would Hashem put us into an illusory world and then make us go into an illusion in the illusion? I mean, isn't that really cruel? You have this dream which is incredibly real, absolutely terrifying. And you sit up in bed shaking and sweating, Baruch Hashem, this is real, that was a dream. Why would he do that to you? And Rav Miller from Gateshead used to illustrate it very beautifully. The answer is there are no exceptions. Everything in the intellectual world and the world of the psyche and the world of human experience is all there to teach you about reality. And the illusion of a dream is the most important learning exercise to teach you about reality. And the reason is this. Imagine you walk up to a friend of yours and you say, you know, this whole world we're living in is illusory. Complete illusion. One day it's all going to fade away and you'll find yourself in reality. Such a person will say, do me a favor. I can only go with evidence. You tell me this is all unreal. It's all an illusion. One day I'll be in reality. That's not for me. Hashem says, you know what? Go to sleep. And in your sleep, you go through an experience that is so terrifyingly real that you think you're going to die. And suddenly, you sit up in bed shaking and sweating and you say, Baruch Hashem, now I'm awake. Can you be sure? Once you've ever been through the experience in your own flesh of having experienced the reality and instantaneously it transitioned into something that showed you that was nothing and this is real, how could you ever go through life after that convinced that the reality you experience now will never change?
Because you wake up.
No.
So if I know I'm going to...
That's right.
And if I know I'm going to wake up,
that's right.
I am awake now. I knew before I was asleep.
That's right. So that's right.
Now I can absolutely make a absolute...
That you're in a situation now from which you one day going to wake up. That's right. Absolutely. Yeah. True. So, anyway, back to the subject. So, you cannot know that you're awake with absolute certainty. And one of the great British philosophers of the last century proved that you can't even know that the world is more than 5 minutes old. Maybe the world was created 5 minutes ago with your head and all your memories in place. Again, it's not relevant and it shouldn't bother people, but it's intellectually possible. And therefore, we are not capable of absolute knowledge. The Ramban says in his Akdama to his work with to the Milchamas and the Baal Amor, the Ramban, look it up in Bringing the Brochas, the Ramban says that we are not capable of absolute knowledge, and he says the level of certainty you can achieve in Torah is not even as good as in mathematics and engineering. He says it openly. He says, don't bend yourself into a pretzel, basically, he says, force yourself through the eye of a needle to answer every kasha and everything that I raise here, because it's not watertight. Because you can't achieve a level of clarity in Torah, not even the level you can achieve in mathematics and engineering. That's the nature of the subject. That's what he says. But be that as it may, we're not capable of absolute knowledge. Some Mefarshim say that if we were, we'd have no free will. But be that as it may. And therefore, when we're talking about achieving knowledge of Hashem's existence, or any Torah matter, we are talking about good enough evidence. We're not talking about proof. When you advertise proof, you set yourself up for failure. When you advertise, you say, we're going to have this weekend seminar. Come to my seminar. You'll walk in on Friday afternoon as a skeptical, atheistic, you know, individual. You'll walk out on Sunday night as a totally extreme, ultra-orthodox person, blow-drying your payas, you know, and that is not right, because you will not succeed. When you advertise proof and you tell people they'll be convinced, those who aren't convinced, you've done a disservice. They end up weaker and more doubtful than they were before. If you advertise compelling evidence, you can meet that standard. And we're never capable of more than compelling evidence. And even for life and death things, when you trust a surgeon, or you fly on a plane, or you do something really dangerous, like get married, you know, whatever it is, you never have absolute knowledge. All you can ever ask for in life is 85% evidence, 90%, 95%. Somebody says, Rabbi, in the rest of my life I'm forced to accept 90% evidence and in religion I want 100%, I can't deliver the goods. I cannot satisfy such an individual. All I can claim in Kiruv and teaching is that I will give you evidence as compelling as compels you in other areas of your life. When you predicate an area of your life on the evidence that you have, I will meet that standard when it comes to an arachim material and all sorts of material we have to do that. But to advertise proof and fail is not the way to go.
Doesn't the secular world believe that it has 100% proof and you haven't?
No. There's nobody believes there's such a... No intelligent individual, and no one has studied philosophy 101, believes that there is such a thing as absolute knowledge. Human mind is not capable of that. Even in mathematics, you tell us something about the fundamentals of mathematics. Even the basis of mathematics is not regarded as absolutely clear.
But the average secular mind thinks that it is.
So then you need to tell him that he's wrong. Show him that he doesn't know that he's even awake. And then show him that you can meet that standard when it comes to religion. Why set yourself up with a standard that you can't match? You're setting yourself for failure. It's not necessary and it's not true. Okay, so let's continue. Our claim is that you can know that Hashem exists. Knowledge as good as it gets. Now the question becomes, how do you get the knowledge? And secondly, why do we call it belief? Okay, we don't have time today to fully go into the first question, and there are many wonderful sources on it. But just to point a direction to suggest how one opens that conversation, I would suggest this. There are two pillars on which our knowledge is based. When somebody asks you to formalize this area, how do we know that Hashem exists? There's much more than this. But there are two formal pillars of this knowledge. In order of importance, one, we met Him. And two, philosophical scientific inquiry about the world around us. These are both very important pillars and both legitimate approaches. The first is the more important. We met Hashem personally. It was personal experience. And attached to that is a difficulty, which is the fact that I wasn't there personally. So I'm dealing with a story that was handed down to me. And here what you should discuss, and Rav Moshe Shapiro often says, the most important thing to learn with new people is the experience of Matan Torah. That's the most important thing. When you're dealing with someone, it's open enough to explore that area, and you study the sugya and Gemara Shabbos, Pei Ches, Pei Tes, wherever it is, you start there, and you start talking about the experience of Matan Torah. It's a radical thing to study. Just to give you one example, what often makes a deep impression on people when they meet this for the first time. Do you know that experience of meeting Hashem personally is the only time in the history of mankind, that in the East and the West, that any human being has ever claimed that Hashem spoke to him personally with even one witness present? It's an unbelievable claim. It's based on a pasuk. The pasuk says, has there ever been an experience of Hashem taking one nation out of another as I took you out of Mitzrayim? Or hanishma kamohu? Meaning, not only has this never happened, but has anyone even purported to have experienced such a thing? It was written 3,326 years ago. And to date, no one has ever come along. And you know, somebody out there is lying. You know, about all the religious claims in the world, somebody's lying. And if you're lying already, pay a witness. No one in the history of mankind, in the Far East or the West, has ever had the chutzpah to claim that there was even... I'm not talking about miracles. I'm not talking about miraculous experiences. Vodka?
A little bit, thanks.
That's cool.
Thank you. Miracles is a different issue. I've personally seen witch doctors in South Africa do things that are physically possible with my own eyes. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about claiming that God himself spoke to you. The only time in the history of mankind, incredible, incredible things. And you explore other religions, Christianity. Christianity begins with Paul's famous vision on the Damascus Road. Now, it didn't begin with JC, he never claimed to be anything other than Jewish. But Paul came back, Paul was a Jew, of course, and he said, God spoke to me. And the Jew said, who witnessed this revelation? And he said, no, me privately. And they said, not good enough for us. Muhammad came out of his tent. Allah spoke to me and told me this dictation of the Quran. And the Jews said, and who is with you during this revelation? Private revelation. Not good enough for us. And wherever you can go to Utah. Utah. In 1880, Joseph Smith woke up and God spoke to him, and hundreds of thousands of people followed that religion based on the testimony of one individual. It's an unbelievable thing. In our book, that is a level of difficulty with evidence that is incomprehensible. Right? And we're the only claim in the history of mankind that 7.2 million people, if you include the Arab rug, were witness to this experience. But quite honestly, what bothers people much more than that is the accuracy of the transmission. Let's just spend a moment on that. When you speak to an intellectual Westerner, they say, look, whatever happened back then may have happened. But the story is impossible to trust. You know, if I whisper something in your ear and you whisper it in his ear, by the time it gets around here, it will have nothing to do with the original statement. You can show that any time. And you're talking about innumerable thousands of generations through the mists of time. Is there any possibility that it could have been transmitted accurately to us? If you read the anti-Semitic literature on this, right, usually written by Jews, they say, you know what probably happened? There was a band of nomadic Arabs, an Abrahamic family, hanging out in the desert, probably smoking something very good, you know, which kind of led to... And then it got embellished over time, and today it's the Torah. That's what they say. They were eating magic mushrooms, or they were, who knows what they were doing, they had some sort of an experience, a tiny band of people, they told their children, and today it's called the Torah. Right? That claim is so incompetent, and it's so easy to demonstrate. That's one of, when you get attacked with that claim, it's one of the issues you can demonstrate, you can answer so formally and so explicitly and so articulately that it's a great pity not to know the answer. And the answer is this: when they claim that we're talking about innumerable generations of vague transmission, point one you make is this. If you call Sinai, let's call it 3,200 years ago for simplicity, and you call a generation 40 years, enough time for people to tell their children, in fact, even to tell their grandchildren, which is a Torah mitzvah. 40 into 3,200 divides how many times?
80.
80 times. There are only 80 generations between Sinai and us, and we know who they all were. In the Rambam Sagdamata, the Mishnah, he lists the name of every leader of every single generation. We know exactly who they were. We have the original writings. And for at least 2,100 or 2,200 years, we have the original parchments. If you go to here in Yerushalayim, you go to the Dead Sea Scrolls. In the Dead Sea Scrolls is a fragment of every single book of Tanakh except Esther. Every book in Tanakh is represented there except Esther, and they're exactly the same as we have today. My friend Rabecha told me he took his kids there. His 10-year-old climbed up on a box. He looked into the glass case, and he started reading a scroll of Yeshaya that's 2,100 years old. He said, Abba, we learned this in school 10 days ago. Rabecha said, the real miracle is that the kid remembers what he learned 10 days ago. But anyway, here's a kid, here's a child in the modern era. He's reading a scroll of Yeshaya on parchment that is 2,100 years old. That's exactly the way we have it today. Do you know, an incredible experience a few months ago. I was able to get into the Cairo Geniza. You know, in Cambridge, I live in England now. In Cambridge, do you know about the Cairo Geniza? Do you know that in 1896 they were decorating the shul in Fostat in Cairo, right? It's a shul that's near 2,000 years old. The guy decorating it broke through a hole in a wall accidentally, and he found himself in a room with 200,000 documents going back nearly 2,000 years. Shameless that they'd been collecting, right? 185,000 of those documents are now in Cambridge. I held in my own hands a piece of a Sefer Torah written in the 6th century, before Islam became a religion, right? There's Haggadahs there from the year 1100. There's Tanakh. By the way, Tanakh was written then with the vowels above the letters, not beneath it. Fascinating to see. The Haggadahs there have got 5 questions, not 4. They've got the same 4 questions than us, and the 5th one, why don't we eat roasted meat on this night? Amazing, amazing things, right? I held in my hands a siddur of a child from the year 1100. It's the only document in color there. All the others are regular cloth. The siddur of a child is decorated in color. On the first page, this child has practiced aleph, 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 base, 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 and then there's a little sketch of himself on his camel. You're talking about Sidurim, Sifrei Torah, you're talking about business letters of the Arizal that they kept. There's a business signature there's a hechsher on cheese, right, from the Rabbonim in Cairo in the 1100. There's ksubas, there's 400 ksubas there. Fascinating history. There's 400 ksubas there. They were written between the Karoim and the conventional Eden, right? With amazing, I held in my hands a ksuba that says like this. This man was marrying a Karai woman. So he writes there like this. I give you the right to sit in darkness on Shabbos, because you know they didn't use, right? Provided you let me use lights on Shabbos. Right? And many amazing conditions. The year the Rambam arrived there, that put a stop to it completely. There's not one single document from the year the Rambam arrived on. There's a heksher on cheese. There's a heksher on cheese from 11 Rabbonim in Cairo, giving a heksher to Karai Jew who made cheese, and they made him swear on a Sefer Torah, because you know they didn't accept Tanakh. So this, the oath they made him take is amazing stuff. Well, there's another story. But the point is that we have documentation, and you're talking about a tradition, you're talking about the same documents, the same Haggadah, the same Sefer Torah, from Jews who've been separated geographically for centuries. You're talking about, do you know the difference between a Sephardi and Ashkenazi Sefer Torah is one letter? Whether you spell Dakar with the Aleph or Gohei, it's not bad for 3,326 years. First of all, can you imagine all Jews agreeing about anything? If that is a miraculous Ladoi or Sinai, it's nothing compared to that. You're talking about a documented history of the same text that goes back 3,000 and vast majority of that time. So when people say to you, this is a vague story embellished through time, it's a ridiculous claim, incompetent claim. Anyway. That's a big sugya. Look that up in the Gemara. The big sugya there about which ksav was originally given, the ksav on the luchos, when they changed, why was it changed? The maskana there is was given in that ksav of the Sefer Torah we have now, changed, and Ezra brought it back. But it's a complicated sugya. Look it up. It's an amazing, amazing sugya, right? There's riots because the osius on the luchos must have had a mem and a samach that the way we have it. So very amazing. Art Scroll did a book on that in English, on the letters of the other place, and at the end they included a summary of the sugya. It's a very good English reference if you want to show somebody the shittas in which sub changed and why and which dates it changed. A very, very good beginning in English if you want to see that sugya. Anyway, the book is called The Wisdom in the Hebrew Alphabet, an Art Scroll book like for beginners about the letters, but at the end there's an essay going into the problem of the sub, which is very good for reference. So let's put it like this. The first area is we met him personally. That's an absolutely unique claim in history. You have to deal with the transmission, and that is a fundamental. A classic source on this is a Kuzari, of course. If someone really takes this seriously and they're open enough to study, learn through Kuzari with a person. The Kuzari takes the approach of trying to falsify it. Would it be possible for somebody to voice such a story on a generation and then have it accepted without people ever revealing that it was foisted? That's a classic source, and you have Rabbi Gottlieb from Rosemeyer who wrote a detailed philosophical modern sort of a parish on that, a Kuzari idea, and trying to put it into a modern context. So that's one issue. The second issue is philosophical investigation. The world around us, for example, is the world around us a chaotic mess? I don't mean the human world, that is a chaotic mess. I'm talking about the natural world, astronomy, chemistry, right? Does that suggest design? Does it not suggest design? These are legitimate lines of thinking, but as Rav Wasserman used to point out, that is always proof by exclusion. right? You can never derive Hashem directly. You can only prove that the alternative is weak. And all proofs by exclusion always leave you with no knowledge of the thing itself. Rav Simcha used to put it like this. In mathematics, you can prove a thing in one of two ways. You can either prove it by derivation. You take something you can experience and build it up to its full complexity. Or you prove it by exclusion. A or B must be true. I cannot prove A, but I can disprove B. That's a formal proof of A. But the difference is when you prove a thing by derivation, you end up understanding it. When you prove a thing by exclusion, you know it must be true because the alternative doesn't work, but what it is, you have no idea. For that you need Torah. It's a different... If there is a leap of faith, this is where it is. And that needs a lot of thought. But I'd like to turn our attention, just for a few minutes, to, I think, a much more important and interesting question. And that is, that if there's a pathway of achieving knowledge, why do we call it belief? And I think the answer is this. The word emunah does not translate as belief. In the King James Bible, it's translated as faith or belief. And it's a wrong translation. The reason we think emunah means faith is because we are children of Western culture. So our language is the language of Christianity. But it does not mean that. The word emunah does not translate as faith. It translates as faithfulness from the Sherish Naaman. Right? When you translate emunah as faithfulness, as loyalty, things start to make sense. Let's understand that. First of all, textual. We don't have time now for this. Go through Tanakh, and find every time the Torah uses the word emunah, and see how it translates. Moshe Rabbeinu is holding his hands up in the battle against Amalek. When his hands are up, we win the battle. When his hands sink, we lose the battle. And it says, Vahayu yadav emunah ad bahashamesh. His hands were faith. Ridiculous, you can't translate it that way. His hands were faithful. They stayed put. Wherever you come across this word, in the King James Bible, belief. It's a ridiculous translation. Avram Avinu is speaking to Hashem, and the Torah says, Vehemin Bashem, in the King James Bible, and he believed in God. He didn't believe in God, he was speaking to him. And Navi doesn't believe, he knows. It means he was faithful to this God, even when asked to kill his own child. So, again, look it up textually and work it out for yourself. But the important point is, it is much more felicitously translated as faithfulness than as belief. Blind belief. So here's the question. What does it mean, faithfulness? Why does the Zohar say that faith, emunah, whatever you call it, has two components? The Zohar says that the sugi of emunah has two components, what it calls emes and emunah. Truth and loyalty to the truth. What does that mean? It means this. The human mind and spirit and psyche and personality are built in such a way that you can have a clarity as clear as it gets, as we said before. And then there's another problem. Once you've got the clarity, will you bring it into action? Will you be loyal to the knowledge? In modern English they say, will you walk the walk? So the question is this. But of course, what idiot is going to know a thing clearly and then act in total betrayal of what he knows? You see the direction clearly. This is the truth. What fool is going to see the truth clearly in this direction and walk in the opposite direction? And the answer is you, with all due respect. Because we are built in such a way that you can see a thing clearly and be treacherous to the knowledge. You can see it clearly and walk in a completely opposite direction. The Greeks call this problem the problem of akrasia, the gap between the head and the heart. Knowing it clearly does not guarantee that you'll be faithful to the knowledge. Right? I see some dubious faces. I'll give you an example. Ever tried dieting? Here's how diet works. On the one hand, you see clearly where you want to be. See clearly? Self-image, self-esteem, health, life itself, next summer on the Froom Beach. I mean, it's like clear, right? You see it clearly, right? Doesn't get clearer than that. And you know exactly if you follow this program, that's where you'll get. On the other hand, you've got a little chocolate wedge thing with a bit of cream and a cherry, which represents 10 seconds of pleasure, during which you'll feel like an idiot. But how could you get that wrong? How could you get that wrong? You're talking about total clarity, as close to absolute as it gets on the one side, strong motivation, crystal clear, and ridiculous childish experience of failure on the other side. And a minute later, you're looking at a plate that is licked clean. It's like, how do you get that wrong? How do you get that wrong? How do people get that wrong? You know, I'll never forget, when I was a junior intern in surgery, on one occasion, we got in our hospital, in my ward, a patient who had Berger's disease. Berger's disease is an exquisite genetic susceptibility to nicotine in cigarette smoke. People who have this gene, they're so sensitive, their blood vessels close down when they smoke. So first their fingers fall off, right? Then their hands fall off. There's not one recorded case in a non-smoker. They stop smoking, the disease arrests. They carry on smoking, their body falls apart. This man was a highly intelligent 45-year-old engineer. He had Berger's disease. He came into our ward with a blue leg because the artery supplying his leg had been closing down. He came in with four black toes we had to cut off. He was highly intelligent. He knew more about the disease than we did. This man knew that if he carried on smoking, we had to cut his leg off. 3 weeks later, we had to do an above-knee amputation because he was still smoking. The next time I saw him was a year later. I was a senior intern, and I saw him being wheeled down the hospital corridor in a wheelchair with no legs, still smoking, on his way to losing an arm. By the way, when I mentioned this to a vascular surgeon in New York, he told me that he had a patient like this whom, when he lost his second arm, he had them rig up some wire on the wheelchair so he could carry on smoking, right? So, you've seen people like this? So, I want to know, man stands here with his leg and a cigarette. Let's just get this clear. Leg, cigarette. Leg, cigarette. Leg, man, husband, father, walk, leg, or 30 seconds of pleasure during which you'll feel the cold hand of death. Well, how could you get that wrong? And the answer is it's a long way from here to here, or to here, wherever the problem is. That's the problem. There's a gap between the head and the heart. You can have it as clear as it gets to human beings. That does not guarantee that you'll walk the walk, that you'll bring it down into practice. That's a separate effort of character. To be ne'eman to the emes. The first problem is clarification. How do we work in Kiruv in Judaism? We don't set a person sit on a stone slab and meditate till you're mindless and eat rhubarb. We say start asking questions. We say objectivity. There's nothing off limits. We want rigorous intellectual discipline. But that's not enough. Once that is clear, once that is the questions have been answered, once a person's open to that, once you, there's no guarantee that it'll carry through into action. It's a separate effort. The Zohar puts it like this. This is an amazing thing. This whole clumsy discussion that I'm trying to articulate, the Zohar puts in four words. The Zohar says there's a thing called emes and a thing called emunah. And it puts it like this. It says, e hu emes, ve e hi emunah. He is truth, and she is faith. What it says? Meaning, in the male-female duality that underlies all reality, the Zohar is telling you there's a male faculty called emes, and then there's a female faculty called emunah, which means that there's a male drive, ability, fascination, talent for clarification. Doesn't mean all men, but we're talking about maleness. And then there's a female ability to bring it into the world where there's no logic anymore, but there's a tenacious attachment to a commitment that was made. Let's understand it like this. You know that perhaps the best illustration of this is in the Aruch. The Aruch has a story of the Bor and the Chulda. Bor and Chulda. You like to look this up. The Maharal has an analysis of this in the Siva Emunah. The Maharal has 3 or 4 pages on this, and he says this. Amazing, amazing illustration. Learn this with a beginner. It's very, very powerful. The Aruch says like this. There was the story of the Bor and the Chulda. And look it up in Aruch. It's under base Bor. Here's the story. And of course, every detail Maharal goes into, we don't have time now, but look it up and see how Medaik all the details. It says like this. There was a young woman traveling to visit her father. This is the story of the Bor and the Chulda. By the way, Mukubalim say that the Bor and the Chulda are female and male as well. It's the same two aspects of the story. But be that as it may, this woman was going to visit her father. She was dressed in her best clothing. She had a jewelry on. And as she traveled to see her father, she got lost. And she strayed into a wilderness. And in that wilderness, she accidentally fell into a bor. The bor was deep. She couldn't climb out. Completely abandoned place. And for sure, she would have died there. But as she cried, there just happened to be a young man walking nearby. And he heard her cries. So he walked over to the edge of the bor and he looked down and he said, "Who are you?" So she said her name. She was a Jewish girl. He was a young Jewish man. He was a Kohen, in fact. He said to her, "Are you human?" He thought maybe she was one of the Shadim in the desert. She said, "I'm human." He said, "I want a shvur. I want you to make an oath." How would that help, by the way? Won't a liar swear that he's telling the truth? Because the dark side cannot use Hashem's name. And yet, to make a shvur, you have to use Hashem's name. So she made a valid shvur, and he said, "Right, I believe you. Now it's clear to me. If I save you, will you marry me?" So she said, "Yes." I mean, she didn't have much choice, did she? So the Aruch says, he lifted her out of the pit and he wanted to marry her on the spot. He wanted to consummate the marriage on the spot, right? We're talking maleness here. You have to understand what's being said here. So she said, "That's not decent. We don't behave that way. I'll go back to the town where I live and get ready for the wedding. You go back to your town and prepare. Then you come meet my parents. And then we'll get married. So the young man agreed. But before parting, they wanted to make a vort. And for that, you need Elim. There were no Elim, it was a desert. So they decided that since there were no other Elim, they would take the boar itself to be an aid. And a chulda, you know, a ferret, a weasel, a wildcat, whatever it was, running past. The boar and the chulda would be the Elim. And they promised each other, they get married, and the boar and the chulda Elim. She went back to her town and began preparing for the wedding. He went back to his town and forgot. Forgot. We're talking males, right? By the way, it's even more humiliating. It says, Kevan she'ava mipaneh, which means as soon as she was out of sight, he forgot. What happened? He met another woman subsequently. He got married. She became pregnant. She had a child. The child fell into a bor and died. Subsequently, she had pregnant again. She had another child. The child was eaten by a chulda. At that point, the woman turned to her husband and she said, this is bizarre. And then he remembered the story. And he told her the story. And she said, oh, is that right? In that case, you divorce me. And you see, it's a woman who's waiting and a woman who's teaching him. You divorce me and you go back to the town that you remember that girl said she came from those years before. And he did. He divorced her. And he made his way to the town that he remembered was where the girl said. And he walked into the town and he found her father. And he said, I'd like to see the girl. And the father said, you can no longer see her. She's lost her mind. Becoming, waiting so long, she's being insane. People go near, she shreds their clothing. But he begged to be allowed to see her. He walked into the room where the girl was. She was behaving insane fashion. She started shredding his clothing. He said to her, Boran Khulda, she recognized him. And then she revealed to him that she'd been pretending to be insane so that no one else could marry her because she was waiting. They got married. They had a happy life together. They had children. What's being said here in this Aruch? Maleness, femaleness. What is maleness? Clarification. Absolute clarification. Give me all the proofs. Instant gratification. Instant results. And staying power? Zero. Zero. What's the female? Clarification? Zero. Hopeless. Lost completely. Doesn't know where she is. Wanders into a desert. Falls into hopeless. Staying power? Unbelievable. You made a commitment. Doesn't matter how illogical. You gave your word. Your word is your bond. You know, this at this point in the discussion, depends who you're speaking to. If you're speaking to somebody who's older than 50, or 60 or 70, they understand what you say, because they come from a world where your word was your bond. They come from a world where their parents and grandparents, they gave their word in business and a handshake was all it took. Today people sign in blood and no one takes it seriously. There's no commitment or loyalty left in the world that we... But that's the story. The story is MS, clarification, emunah, male, female. To be an integrated human being, you need both faculties. There's a faculty of clarification, of rayas, of evidence, of building. But then there's another faculty, and that is the bringing it down into action, the commitment, the walking the walk, and it's a completely different issue. Why is this female, by the way? Because you see the pulse so clearly. What is the male polarity? Take the conception of a child. What are the two works of male and female? The male work is only a flash of clarity. It's the giving of a half of a genetic code. That's all there is. There's no staying power that's involved at all when a child is conceived. There's a moment of inspiration, of instigation, of clarity. That's all there is, and it disappears. The female work is day after day of a pregnancy, day after day after day, that ends in danger and difficulty and threat to life. And that completely logical experience of birth is what brings life to the world. You know, it is so illogical. If a man stepped into a room where a woman was giving birth, who had no idea how children are born, and he witnessed that, you know, he'd probably call the police. I don't know what he'd do. He'd need therapy the rest of his life. I mean, and if he had to go through it, he would never recover. There's no question about that. But it's that experience. And you know, the Rambam says that when a woman's giving birth, it looks clearly like two people are dying. The woman looks like she's dying in agony. And the child looks like it's dying. You know, the Rambam, being a doctor... The context, there's no time to go into now, but the Rambam explains that when a child is born, it goes through a transition from a situation of absolute life conditions into a world where they all spell death. You know, the child in the womb is built in such a way that he has dozens of conditions that keep him alive in that situation, underwater with no air to breathe. He's got holes in his heart. The blood flows in a reverse direction that it does in you. He's got different type of blood. He's got blood vessels coming out of his liver. Right, he's got a major blood vessel, one of the biggest in the body, taking all the blood away from the lungs instead of towards the lungs. He's got no lungs, they're tiny little scrunched up pieces of tissue. He's got all the conditions he needs for living perfectly like that. If you gave him any of the conditions of your body, you'd kill him. And if you gave a a person who's born, any of the conditions of the fetus, you'd kill him. Since they're living in a life and death opposite mode of a child who's born in the world. And then he starts to be born. There's no way he's going to live. He's got 25 different reasons why he's going to die. And speaking as a doctor, I've done this dozens of times. You hold a newborn child, you deliver the baby, you hold it in your hands, and you stand there watching the child basically die. He goes blue. A minute later, he's deep purple, makes these gasping movements. He's bleeding furiously. A newborn child is about this much blood. That's all. And he's pumping it furiously up to waist through a damaged placenta. There's no way this kid's going to survive. And as you stand there helplessly, suddenly the umbilical cord clamps down like a cord of steel, stops the bleeding. At exactly the same moment, the holes in the heart close. The blood reverses direction. At exactly the same moment, the blood vessel taking the blood away from the lungs closes down. The blood reverses direction, hits the lungs. At exactly the same moment, takes his first breath. The lungs pop open. The air goes in. And 3.5 minutes later, he's doing fine. That must have taken a good few million years in the trees to get right by accident, because a lot of monkeys, you know, I mean. So you're witnessing a transition that only a woman can understand. She's been through that. By the way, that's why we sing Heshus Chayil on Friday night. Because when the week transitions into a messianic premonition, it's a woman's birth. Chevle Mashiach is a woman's experience. Right? Do you know there's a medrash? Am I speaking too long? There's a medrash that says this. The medrash says that before the Mashiach comes, the Arabs will have a building on the Har Habayis. Look this up. It's a long medrash called Beis HaMedrash. A Medrash Tanoim, written 4 centuries before Islam became a religion. And here's what it says. The Bnei Ishmael, couldn't be clearer, the Bnei Ishmael will have a building on the Har Habayis. This was written before, how Chazal knew then, what the final tension would be. At a critical moment in Jewish history, it's a long Medrash, it's 5 or 6 pages long. The leaders of the Jewish people approach the Arabs, and they say to them, remove your building, we want to rebuild the Beis HaMikdash. The Arabs say nothing doing, it's our holy place. There's a moment of tension, and then the Arabs turn to the Jews, and they say to them, let's not fight. You Jews build a Mizbeach, an altar, put a sacrifice on, like in days of old. We'll build an altar and put a sacrifice on, and let's see which one Hashem chooses. Let's see if Fire Min HaShemayim comes for, because we have the real Emunah, in case you hadn't noticed. We're serious about our faith. And therefore, you Jews put a sacrifice, we will do the same. Whichever one Hashem accepts, we have a deal with you. If he accepts ours, you join our religion. If he accepts yours, we'll follow the Torah. And the Jews agree. The Medrash says the Jewish people make a mizbech, they put a korban on. The Arabs put a mizbech, put a korban on. And fire comes min haShamayim for the Arabs' offering. You're talking about a birth experience where the evidence is all death experience. All evidence is wrong. That's, if it's logical, it's not a test of emunah. Not a test of commitment. The Arabs turn to the Jews and they say, we had a deal. All the Jews say, never. Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad. There's a terrible battle. Those who survive flee to the desert. And after 40 days of hiding in the desert, the Mashiach arrives. And then the Medrash goes to Hebron. He wakes up the Avos. He leads them out of the Machpelah. Very, very beautiful Medrash. I once asked Rav Simcha, is that how it will be? And he said, it will be exactly like that. Meaning, all the evidence will... The beginning is easy. When a child is conceived, the male has no problem at all. There's a flash of inspiration that couldn't be clearer, and then he's gone. And then the woman's experience gets more difficult and more difficult, and finally you enter crisis where all it looks like is death. And all the evidence is against you. And that's when the strength of character, that is the strength of emunah, being ne'eman, that's when it comes in. It's a completely different exercise than the MS experience. And the Zohar says you need both of those to be an integrated human being. The Rambam says that life is like standing on a dark plane on a stormy night. He says in the Moira, the Rambam says life is like standing on a dark plane on a stormy night. You stand there beaten by the rain, lashed by the wind, hopelessly lost. And the moment of greatest darkness and total despair, suddenly there's a flash of lightning. And that instant of lightning, you see the road clearer than by day. And as you see it, the light disappears. And the rest of the night is walking through the storm on memory alone of a flash of lightning that you once saw. Rambam says some people see more flashes of lightning, some people see less, but nobody walks in the light. And therefore there are rare moments of male clarity, inspirational, conceptual moments, and long periods of difficulty of wading through the storm, and that's a female experience of bringing to fruition and bringing to birth what must be real. Let me finish with a story. We have to finish at 1, right? I'll finish with a story. If it doesn't move you, there's no hope for you. In 1942, the Japanese invaded the Philippines. 1944, they left. After the Japanese left, close to the end of the war, a series of peculiar incidents occurred in the Filipino jungle. People were being shot to death. Why? 30 people died. Because one Japanese soldier got left behind by accident. He was a highly intelligent man. He was an officer. His name was Lieutenant Onoda. And he carried on fighting the war. You know, Japanese orders were fight to the death. There was no surrender. He carried on fighting the war, personally, privately. He was the only man left behind, hiding in the jungle, and killing the enemy wherever he could. This went on for a long time. It went on for 30 years. 30 years! I've seen a photograph. 54 years old! In his uniform, patched up, with his gun. In 1974, the Japanese government, you know, were getting complaints. 1974, they decided to do, they sent into the Filipino jungle a Major Suzuki, and he found him, in his uniform, fighting the war. He said to him, "What are you doing, Onoda?" He said, "I'm following my instructions. My commanding officer gave me instructions to, and I'm doing that." He said to him, "You are being totally illogical." Onoda said, "A soldier's duty is not to be logical, it's to do his duty. If every soldier starts thinking logically, you don't have an army." He said to him, "Do you know the war's over?" He said, "I'm not a fool, of course. What are you doing?" He said, "I'm doing my duty. I'm being loyal to my task." Talk about Emunah. It doesn't get better than that. He could not convince him to go home. Suzuki went home and Onoda carried on fighting. The Japanese high command put their heads together and they came up with a solution. They found an elderly officer who had been present during the original Japanese evacuation. They sent him back into the Filipino jungle with the original Japanese demobilization order. He found him in the jungle. He called him to attention. And he read him the original order to lay down weapons and go home. Onoda handed over his gun. He went back to Japan. The Filipinos called him a hero. They bought him a new blue suit. It's very emotional. He arrived at Tokyo airport to see his family for the first time in 30 years. He left the pre-war Japan. He came back to a modern industrial. It was an amazing story. But the point I want to make is this. Imagine you're standing there in the jungle. You're not a let's go home. And he says, "No." And you say, "Why?" And he says, "Because I'm doing my duty." And you say, "You're being illogical." And he says, "Logic? That's this. I'm doing this. I'm doing my duty. I'm loyal to my task. I don't waver from that." What? No Japanese mentalities. I read an article in the newspaper about a Japan Airlines 747 captain a couple of years ago. He landed badly at Tokyo airport. A bad landing. The plane was undamaged, no one was hurt, but it was a very unprofessional landing. The man dignified, silently went home, put a knife in his stomach and killed himself immediately. Yeah, betrayed the airline, betrayed the profession. No question. Life's not worth it. So Onoda was fighting his war. You know, but he was doing something wrong. I mean, people were dying. So in London, a couple of years ago, I asked this question to a group of young school children. I said, "Look, that ne'emons, that emunah, that tenacious attachment to duty doesn't get better than that. For 30 years, the man continues with his job. But he's doing something wrong, isn't he?" So one young girl put up her hand and she said, "Yes, you know what he was doing wrong? He had emunah, but he didn't have emes." You need both. It's got to be right, and then you've got to be committed to it. One without the other is ridiculous. If you have this without this, you're like the great British philosopher of the last century who taught the highest principles of moral philosophy, and one morning his students found him crawling out of a house of very ill repute, very disgusting place. He said, "Professor, you taught us such great moral principles. How can you behave like this?" He said, "What's the problem? Does a mathematician have to be a triangle?" And if you have this without this, you have the Arab problem. You have unbelievable attachment, tremendous faith, with scrambled eggs up here. Chaos. You kill anybody, kill your own people. This is mayhem. I don't know which is more dangerous. But that is the issue. The issue is our approach is a twofold approach. It's based on rigorous intellectual discipline. The Gemara is totally uncompromising. That's a training. The first thing we train people in is intellectual objectivity, to see things as they are. In the Muslim world, we try to teach people to see themselves as they are. But it begins and ends with logical clarity and objectivity. But that's only half the story. That's the male part of the integrated marriage that a human being has. Then you have to bring it down into the female. And therefore, that is, I think, a beginning approach to the subject. We're not talking about leaps of faith and born-again experiences and emotional stuff. We're talking about a rigorous intellectual training, that's the glory of Torah history, and yet we're talking about people who could go through the experiences even when all the evidence was against them. And a birth process that looks like a death because you have made a commitment. in the beginning of Jewish history, we had a male experience. We had Torah Shebichsav. Hashem is speaking openly. He appeared in the world. There were Nisim. He was speaking openly in the world. And we are deep in the face of Torah Shebaal Peh. We haven't seen Nisim. We haven't heard Hashem speak. There's been no Nevuah for 2,350 years. We are very close now to the 6,000-year limit, deep in the female phase of history, where all we have left to expect is a completely illogical test, where all we'll have, all the evidence will be against us, and all we'll have is the power of a commitment that we knew, where the flash of lightning that we saw long ago, that we still remember, and that will bring us to a fulfillment of what we call Ihu Emes Vehi Emunah.